During the 1,000 years of Christ's reign over the earth, the nations will be compelled to recognize his power and might, for he is to rule with a rod of iron and to dash to pieces any who dare lift themselves up against him. Discontent and disloyalty will be driven underground by fear, and malcontents will render feigned obedience to him. Any sign of resistance will be punished immediately by death. Trench suggests that this age is one of constant discriminating judgment, detecting, convicting, and punishing by death all those in whose lives sin breaks out in overt acts. Nevertheless, divine blessing will cover the earth, and prosperity will be the universal experience. Despite all the tokens of God's goodness during the long millennial age, there will be masses of people who have never turned to God, and who remain unrepentant still. Conscious of the evil of their own hearts, such will shrink from the holiness of God's earthly center, and will gravitate to areas as far away as possible from Jerusalem, the four corners of the earth. There they will share their common antipathy to the messianic rule, and evidence their incorrigible hostility to the king, and their antagonism to righteousness and holiness. As the centuries elapse, there will doubtless be larger questions to the ranks of the malcontents, until, at the close of the dispensation, vast numbers will be in a state of incipient revolt against the rule of Christ and his people. Human nature is incurably corrupt. At every test, even in the most favorable conditions of the millennium, serves but to demonstrate man's utter inability, apart from divine help, to live in a manner glorifying to God. At the commencement of the millennium, the devil will be held prisoner in what the apocalypse terms the bottomless pit. For 1,000 years, his unceasing activity will be halted, and mankind free from his malevolent influence. But at the close of the age, he will be released for a little season. With unabated hatred of God, he will issue forth to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth. The precise procedure adopted, or the exact nature of his deception, is not stated, but it is probable that the satanic appeal to the nations will be to establish their own government and to overthrow that of the Messiah. Galled by the superior position of Israel and their own enforced subordination to a nation so long despised, they will readily respond to the appeal and will gather together to battle. Revelation discloses that the rebellious hosts will be as numberless as the sands of the sea. During the millennium, all nations will be required to go up to Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles. This may, of course, imply delegations from each nation, rather than the total population of each country. The majority of Jews will naturally assemble at the temple in Jerusalem for the feast. The obligation on the nations to be represented at Jerusalem for the feast will only emphasize the Gentile subjection to Israel and consequently irritate still further the peoples. Evidently, the opportunity will be seized for a large number to make their way to the city without exciting suspicion. Lift their Trojan horse within the gate. The great army gathered by the devil will audaciously attack the city, clearly with the intention of massacring those followers of Christ, and possibly of destroying the king as well. Herod's answer will be swift, but before the sword is unsheathed or a weapon used, the fire of God will fall upon the rebels and consume them. The devil, the age-long deceiver of mankind, having now been finally defeated, will be cast forever into the lake of fire, there to join the Western Emperor and the Jewish ruler who were consigned to their place of suffering 1,000 years earlier. This is final and conclusive. The ill-fated rebellion, after such a long period of bliss and prosperity, is a sad commentary on human nature, unaffected and unchanged by the king's beneficence. The millennium is to be the consummation the final and perfect state of the world's history, and the temporary fulfillment of the prophecies of the kingly glory of Christ, is the last of a long series of divine tests by which man has been proved by God. It is the severest test of all, because it is the condition of privilege higher than man has ever enjoyed before. Well over 4,000 years ago, the extent of man's sin and disregard of every moral and spiritual standard provoked judgment on the race and the earth which they inhabited. With the exception of one family of 8 persons, every human being perished in the flood. And Peter declared that the world, being overflowed with water, perished. Because of the sin of a later day, judgment will again fall upon the earth. And since the heavens too are defiled, they also will suffer at the hand of God. Destruction on this occasion will not be by water, but by fire. The heavens and the earth, says the apostle, are reserved unto fire against the day of judgment. The destruction of that future day is to be devastatingly complete. It will come unexpected as a thief. On that day, the heavens will disappear with a great rushing sound. The elements will disintegrate in flames, and the earth and all that is in it will be made bare. Since the whole universe is to break up in this way, that day will set the heavens ablaze until they fall apart and will melt the elements in flames. Centuries earlier, Isaiah had predicted that the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall wax old like a garment, and they that dwell therein shall die in like manner. Joel refers to that period as one in which there will be blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The ultimate dissolution of the world is clearly inevitable. Heaven and earth shall pass away from the Master. The psalmist also predicted that heavens and the earth should perish. The Revelation declares that on the face of the Almighty, the earth and the heavens fled away. There was found no place for them. The words used by Joel and Peter centuries ago could well have been a description of an atomic explosion on a gigantic scale. The great rushing sound of a huge pillar of smoke ascends and breaks out into a tremendous mushroom formation. The blazing fire, the blood-red cloud, the fission of atoms, and disintegration of the elements, the whole picture of nuclear horrors was painted in vivid, by restrained language, by the biblical writers centuries ago. The earth and its ethereal garments are to be completely dissolved, and the whole of their matter converted into heat, light, and energy. A sin-stained earth can find no place in eternity. Dispensations having come to an end, the final and irrevocable decision must be taken regarding the fate of the dead. People living at the second advent of Christ will be dealt with as the judgment of the nations prior to the institution of the millennial kingdom, and the condemned will pass into eternal punishment. The Christian dead will have been raised at an earlier date. The martyrs of the tribulation period will be raised at the beginning of the millennium to reign with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead, that is all the unregenerate, will remain in the grave until the close of the millennium. After the final revolt, and possibly coincidentally with the dissolution of the earth, they are to be raised for judgment. John saw, poised in space, without pillar or support, a great white throne, his purity indicative of the holiness and perfect righteousness of the invisible occupant, and the justice of his decision, and his greatness, indicating not only his infinite majesty and authority, but the finality of the sentence pronounced from that throne. There could be no appeal from that court. All the impenitent, dead spiritually, and in most cases physically, are to be summoned for the last judgment. Great and small must stand before the judge. A century earlier, the description of a final assize conducted in space seemed unrealistic. but no one today would question the practicability. In absolute equity, records of human life will be unrolled, the books were opened, and each individual gentrified on the basis of his deeds. No oral evidence will be required, as in human courts. From the recesses of the individual's own memory, the whole story will be revealed and flashed instantaneously before his mind. Each person will be judged according to his work, plainly implying that there are to be degrees of punishment, and that the judgment is to be a fitting requital. Lest any question could be raised, the seer declares that the book of life will also be opened. The final condemnation must be the absence of a name from that record. The consciousness of their true condition will be borne in upon those who appear before the throne, and in the sudden realization of their guilt and uncleanness, their only desire will be to remove themselves as far as possible from the holiness and purity of that awful throne. They will acquiesce completely with a sentence of eternal banishment from God and a terrible consignment to the second death, the lake of fire. The justice of that sentence will be so obvious that no question can possibly arise. Sin must be punished. Whatever may be implied by lake of fire is not clear, but as the symbol is dreadful, how awful must be the reality. Whatever may be the character of that place of eternal punishment, it is clear that it will be one of permanent and unrelieved suffering. Judgment concluded, the Apostle John saw in a vision a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. The Apostle stood on the threshold of the eternal day, and a new heaven and a new earth appeared before his eyes. The new heaven is for the raised and changed saints, and a new earth is to form the habitation of those during the millennial reign were alive on earth. But it is by no means clear that the inhabitants of the new-made world would be restricted to the believers of the millennial era. Three-quarters of the globe is at present occupied by sea. In the new earth, there is to be no sea. The restless oceans will retreat to provide a world which is completely habitable. The troubled sea is a frequent figure in Scripture of the restless masses of mankind, and its destructive and separative character is remarkably symbolic of the effects of sin upon the human race. The wicked are like the troubled sea, when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. 1 Corinthians 15 discloses that when the Lord Jesus Christ has put down all rule and all authority in power, and put all enemies under his feet, he will deliver up the kingdom to God the Father. His reign as mediatorial king will come to an end when the mediatorial kingdom is incorporated in the eternal kingdom. It is usually suggested that Christ will thereupon cease to reign over the earth or any part of it. There is no biblical reference to his alleged abdication. Revelation 22 specifically refers to the throne of God and of the Lamb. Jesus Christ still reigns, either as God, humanity being subordinate, or as a God-man. The end of the mediatorial kingdom is followed by the commencement of the timeless and unending period of the eternal state. God's tabernacle, or center of administration, in the form of a beautiful city, will descend from heaven, and God will dwell among the inhabitants of the earth and will be their God. In that day, death will be banished, and grief, crying, and distress will be abolished. Corruption and mortality will find no place in the new economy. The new earth will be a scene of beauty, and a sphere of spiritual blessing. Although details recorded are limited and do not fully indicate the incomparable bliss of eternity.